Hello and welcome to Juno Afternoon. It's Monday, June 16th, and it's a glorious afternoon. Thank you for sharing it with KTOO. Today, in the studio is Jeff Brown, who engineers my show. My name is Joan Pardis. I'm your Monday host. Today we have Rob Steedel in to talk about CBJ activities. We're going to talk about the Whale Watch Cruise for Hospice and Home Care of Juno, and also find out about Student Travel Services, the Juno Travel Services Foundation, that Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A pipeline spill of toxic wastewater in northern Alberta, Canada, is affecting First Nations in the remote area. A cleanup is taking place, but as Dan Karpinchuk reports, Native leaders want answers.
The pipeline is operated by a Texas-based oil company, Apache Canada Limited. It carries industrial wastewater extracted during oil and natural gas operations. The site of the spill is a remote area not far from the border with the Northwest Territories. Officials say more than 2 million gallons of the toxic wastewater have leaked into an area of about 100 acres. Local Native leaders say the trees, vegetation, and soil are dead, and the water is contaminated, and that's impacted wildlife as well. Suzanne Bailey is an environmental scientist. She says the massive spill of treated industrial wastewater contains oil, gas, salt, and other minerals.
The salt will dilute out. The trees will return, and the other things will return when it's flushed out with fresh water. How many other kinds of pollutants are with that salt? That's the issue from my perspective.
Bailey says if the water reaches waterways, it will kill fish, and it will take about 2 years for the vegetation to grow back. Crews from Alberta's Environment Ministry are already on site cleaning up, but Native leaders want some answers from the pipeline operator about what happened and what's going to be done about it. Some officials also say there are indications that because of its size, the spill occurred possibly during the winter and wasn't discovered until recently. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A report out today by the Canadian Human Rights Commission shows continuous disadvantages among Aboriginal people. The Equality Rights Data Report compares Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people on education, employment, economic well-being, and health and housing. The report shows lower incomes among Aboriginal people and says they're more likely to be abused, be victims of violent crimes, and more likely to be incarcerated. The document was compiled from a number of studies between 2005 and 2010. The Human Rights Commission hopes it will be used by stakeholders and government departments to address Aboriginal issues. A bipartisan group of U.S. lawmakers is fighting to win federal recognition for six tribes in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Matt Laszlo has more from Washington.
The tribes have treaties dating back to the 1600s, but there's a catch. The agreements are with the King of England. Even now, the U.K. recognizes and honors these American tribes, while the U.S. government doesn't. That's partly because in 1924, a law was passed that declared Virginia contained no Native Americans and wiped the Commonwealth's record books of their history. Northern Virginia Democrat Jim Moran says that period is a blot on the state's record.
The history of this denial is a true stain on Virginia's history.
The six tribes are fighting for federal recognition that would provide them educational and health care benefits enjoyed by other tribes. It also would allow them to collect ancestors' remains that are kept at the Smithsonian. Steve Adkins of the Chickahominy tribe says it's time their heritage is honored.
We weren't Indians by choice, we were Indians by birth.
The House has passed legislation recognizing Virginia's tribes twice. So has the Senate committee, but the full upper chamber has never recognized the tribes. Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner says he's optimistic the delegation can apply the needed pressure.
Each year we get a little bit further down the path. This needs to be the year we get it done.
While optimistic, supporters say the legislation won't likely come up until near the end of this session, which means, after waiting about 400 years, these tribes continue to wait. Reporting from the Capitol, I'm Matt Laszlo.
U.S. New Mexico lawmakers announced Friday legislation has been introduced to improve tribal education and language preservation. The bill would improve existing programs while creating new incentives to encourage educational success. Some of the ways it would do this is by offering scholarships and loan forgiveness. According to the New Mexico delegation, graduation rates for Native students are less than other groups. During this month in 2012, the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes celebrated the 30th anniversary of the Mission Mountain Tribal Wilderness Area. More than 90,000 acres in northwest Montana were preserved for cultural and spiritual use. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Hello, thank you for listening to Juno Afternoon. You are listening to KTOO News Juno. I'm your Monday host of Juno Afternoon, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is the engineer extraordinaire for my show. He runs the board. And as far as the weather is concerned, we all know it's been days and days and days and days of fantastic weather. There is talk of isolated thunderstorms. They've been talking about this for the last couple of days. I've been reading about it, and none have appeared, but it would be exciting to have a thunderstorm in Juneau. We had one 9 years ago in about a week. I know that. I took my daughter home from the hospital, and there was a thunderstorm that night. A little foreboding. So anyway, here, right now, in 2013, the weather is sunny, isolated thunderstorms in the late afternoon. Tonight, mostly cloudy, scattered showers. Tuesday, mostly cloudy, but like you, I don't believe it. Anyway, our first guest today is Rob Steedle. He's the Deputy City Manager for the City and Borough of Juneau. Hi.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well, enjoying the weather, as we all are.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, CBJA, for bringing this on.
Oh, yes.
So, Rob, let's start with the very basics. What does the Deputy City Manager do?
The Deputy City Manager fills in for the City Manager. So, Ms. Kiefer and I have split up all of the CBJ departments, and about half report to her and about half to me. But we spend a lot of time talking with each other about issues that are coming up from the Assembly, from citizens. And we keep each other apprised of what's going on in the departments we directly oversee, so that on occasions like this, when she's out of town for a few days, I can be of assistance to the departments that report directly to Kim.
Okay. And do both of you have to go to all the Assembly meetings? Is that part of your
we
job?
Both go to all the Assembly meetings because we really have to stay in the loop. But we do take time off occasionally.
That's good. I'm happy to hear that because we want well-rested and well-rounded officials. So let's talk about the Assembly meeting. There's one tonight, correct?
Actually, tonight there's an Assembly Lands Committee meeting. And I think the most interesting topic for your listeners will be the lands manager, Greg Cheney, will be looking for direction from the committee on whether or not a proposal that was brought forward to them last year about two parcels, one at Schweitzer Creek and one at Peterson Hill, which is just before Auk Lake as you're heading outbound. So this CBJ owns a great deal of land there. Whether those parcels should be brought to the market, developed in some way, look for a purchaser. This was brought to the Lands Committee last year. They decided that further study was needed. Since that time, they formed an ad hoc housing committee, which has taken suggestions from bankers and builders and developers and realtors and other interested parties for what the CBJ should be doing to address Juneau's housing shortage. And a number of suggestions came in. And one of them was to make CBJ land available for development. Another one was don't have the government competing with the private sector. So there's a line there, and the Lands Committee is going to have to decide what side of that line they want to be on.
So CBJ owns a lot of public land. When was the last time that public land was up for sale for development? Do you know?
The last major one was the Lena Point subdivision when the NOAA road was built.
Right.
And some of those parcels are still available. We'll be renewing attempts to sell them. So most of those sold, there are still parcels available there.
Right. So that was in the last I don't know, 10 to 15 years, I don't know.
Correct.
Yeah. So you talked about an assembly ad hoc housing committee. Can you tell me what an ad hoc committee is?
It forms around a specific issue. So the assembly has standing committees, the lands committee, finance, public works and facilities, and human resources. But this issue was identified that Juneau needs to do something about the housing shortage, and so a subset of assembly members were appointed by the mayor to serve on the ad hoc housing committee. And the work of that group is winding down, and they're going to be bringing recommendations forward to the assembly as a whole, sitting as the committee of the whole at an upcoming work session,
right,
probably on July 1st.
So the ad hoc housing committee is comprised completely of assembly members?
Correct.
And are all of the assembly ad hoc meetings comprised of assembly members? Or sometimes are there other people? I'm just wondering, do you sometimes bring in subject matter experts, or is it this ad hoc committee and then the assembly goes out to the subject matter experts and hears all the different sides?
That's exactly how it works, John. So everyone that is a member of the committee is an assembly member.
Mm-hmm.
But the purpose of this committee was to learn from the experts. So,
right,
the
a definitive task of
exactly
gather the information, mm-hmm, for this. And so not everybody has to do it. So they present it to the whole, even though anyone could obviously do the research.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right, so that's what's happening tonight, talking about opening up public lands. And then what happens next week?
Well, at the upcoming assembly meeting, there are a couple of items that may be of interest. One is the ordinance for adopting the new FEMA flood maps will be on the consent agenda, and then the public hearing for that will be at the following regular assembly meeting.
So what's the date of that for the public meeting? 2 Mondays? July 1?
July 1.
Yes.
No, July 1 will be a committee of the whole. I uh-huh. don't remember the date of that.
If it'll you're be, interested, they can
I
probably go to
July 19th, actually.
Okay, because people might be interested in doing public comment on that.
There have been a number of community meetings around the flood maps. There are imperfections with the new flood maps, as there are with the existing flood maps. About 226, I think the number is, of the 389 or so properties that now have flood insurance will no longer be required to have flood insurance. But about an equal number of properties that currently don't need flood insurance will be required to have it if the homeowner has a mortgage on the structure on that property.
Interesting. Hang on 1 second. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO, and we're talking with Rob Steedel, the Deputy City Manager for CBJ, about the possible adoption of these new flood maps, and that will be talked about at the next assembly meeting, not tonight, but a week from Monday. So what are the ramifications if you get off the current flood map? You don't have to have the flood insurance.
Correct.
But why is there that there were these properties that were on flood maps and now they're not, and now there's other properties that weren't that are now on? So what has changed?
What's changed is better data for the most part. So the last time we adopted maps was over 15 years ago, and now we have a much better systems for determining whether or not structures are in the floodplain. But another big change that moved properties into it was a new model for coastal flooding has been adopted, and all of Auk Lake is now in what's called a velocity flood zone, which it previously was not. And CBJ has been working with FEMA officials on whether or not that model is applicable to that area, whether or not it's valid. FEMA believes it is. We will continue working with them. So we need to adopt these maps in order for homeowners here to remain eligible, to remain in the federal flood insurance program. But we will continue working with FEMA to bring as many properties as should be out of it.
Okay. And then the public comment process is they could send emails to assembly members and they could show up for
the public hearing in mid-July.
Mid-July, and there'll be notices about that.
Yep.
So, okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
There is not.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
All righty. Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with our next guest.
Shadow in the city, all around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match, yeah. But tonight it's a different world, go out and find a girl, come on and dance all night, despite the heat it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. In the city, dressed so fine and looking so pretty. Cool cat looking for a kitty, gonna look in every corner of the city. Till I'm wheezing like a bus stop, running up the stairs, gonna meet you on the rooftop. But tonight it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on, hit that all night. Just like the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city.
Welcome back. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. Jeff Brown is my engineer extraordinaire. And our next host, our next guest is Colleen Jones from Hospice and Home Care of Juno. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Oh, glad to have you. So Hospice and Home Care of Juno is having an event this Saturday. You want to tell me about it?
Yes. We are having our annual whale watching fundraising cruise sponsored so graciously by Allen Marine Tours. And it's, yeah, Saturday, the June 22nd from 1 to 4 p.m. At the Auk Bay Statter Harbor. So if people want to come, you need to arrive a little bit before 1 o'clock, so 12:30, 12:45 to board.
Okay. And then the tickets are $60. And to get a ticket, you say there's about maybe 10 or 15 tickets left. We talked before we went
yes.
on air.
Yeah. So if you're interested in a ticket, you can call our office at 463-6111 is the main desk. Or my number is 463-6106. But I'm part-time. So if you don't get me, always can get somebody at the front desk.
Right. And with only 10 or 15 tickets
yes.
left, you definitely may want to give a buzz because it's been amazing whale watching. I hear I've been watching, looking at pictures of bubble mm-hmm. feeding and breaching and
yeah.
tail slaps. It's just been a spectacular show.
Right.
So that's from 1 to 4. I'm looking at the weather. It says mostly cloudy, so it sounds like a good day for Saturday.
Oh, it'll be, yeah. Doesn't matter what the weather is. The whales perform.
Yeah. How nice of
yes. them.
So let's talk a little bit about hospice and home care, where this the money from this fundraiser will go. How it goes directly to that organization.
Yes. All the fundraising goes directly towards hospice and home care. We have our budget, and a percentage of that is relied upon by fundraisers. And so, it's a very important, but we have a few fundraisers each year. This is one of them. We have the Light Up a Life in the winter during the Christmas season. We have our Heart of Hospice Fun Run. But basically, it supports those that we provide services to anyone, regardless of their ability to pay, whether they have insurance or not. And so when somebody doesn't, those funds, you know, fill in those gaps.
Okay.
And so that's what that, you know,
yeah, that's
how it
wonderful.
Supports it.
And so let's talk about Hospice and Home Care of Juneau and what they actually do. So it's part of Catholic Community Services.
It is,
correct?
And we're under their umbrella, absolutely.
Right. And what are the services? I think that there's a lot of misconception about hospice and also
and
the home care part of it.
Yeah, well, it's probably expanded. I've only been with them a little over a year, but, you know, it generally was just hospice, and then we became home care, where we provide skilled nursing to patients or that are discharged from the hospital but still need a little bit of nursing care, or those that are terminally ill. That's the hospice part. But we have, you know, the nursing, we have physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, social workers, chaplains that provide just support, bereavement counseling. It's just a multitude. It's a team effort to support these families during this transition time of either getting well or you know, ending their lives. So we try to meet their needs wherever they are.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the hospice part. Now, I have some experience with hospice because my father was a patient of hospice here, and the team was unbelievable. Could not ask for a better group of people to be with my dad and my family during that time.
Mm-hmm.
But for people who may not be familiar with hospice, when you talk about terminally ill, some people think that it's like it has to be like happening right now.
It's a diagnosis. Usually if a physician will say you've got approximately 6 months, and that's when we like to step in, or we offer that, as the physicians offer that to that patient and family, would you like to be on a hospice roster? And so that's where we would step in if they want our services. So, yeah, 6 months is kind of the general guideline, but you never know how a patient is going to, what time. So often they are held with the skilled nursing care. They often last a little longer, but that's okay. They will still stay on our services.
Right. And in my experience, that's exactly what happened.
Oh, it did.
And also that the team of professionals with hospice really allowed my dad to stay in my home. Without that team of professionals,
right,
I didn't have the skill set to deal with his needs. So it was just really fantastic.
Yeah, and that is a big part of it. Sorry that to allow them to stay at home in their dwelling, whichever they. Yeah,
which turned out to be my home, not his home, but that was fine.
Yeah.
And then the home care is just, it's kind of recuperative.
Right, yes. And so that's very variable from a week to God knows how long. We have some people on there for a long time that they need, you know, checkups every week or whatever, every month. So it's just, it's very dependent on the patient, but often it's very short term when they just need a little more skilled nursing care at home until they are fully recovered.
For the home care part of it.
Right.
And so Hospice and Home Care of Juneau, you have a team of professionals, you have your fundraising calendar, and I'm sure you're fueled by a lot of volunteers.
We do. We have a wonderful team of volunteers that really help me and help the whole team do their jobs. We have one of the groups is those that provide respite for the hospice families and the patients, so they can go into the home. They're very well trained, and they either have a desire to you know, participate in that role. And then we have another group of volunteers, or what I call the special projects, and that's they help me with fundraisers. And so I've got a great team helping with the whale watching crew. And then I have another group that help with delivering of medical equipment to the homes. Like even just today, less than an hour ago, I'm delivering a hospital bed to a new hospice patient. And so we really work together. Sometimes it's very short notice, and sometimes I have a few days. And those that are strong enough and able and willing and flexible help me, you know, transport equipment to those homes.
That's great. To go back to that first set of volunteers, the respite, in my experience, what happened is they found somebody my dad was an avid fisherman. He was living in Florida at the time, but then he moved up to Alaska. We're from New York, but anyway, so that was the trajectory. But they found a person who really wanted to volunteer, and he was a fisherman, so they just came and they just talked fish.
Yeah, we do try to match them up with the patient, whatever their special interests are. If we have somebody that also shares that, it's a nice, you know, common link that they can have together. So we do kind of screen that. What are their interests? What's their background? And what do they like to do or talk about? Or if they just need somebody to be present with them. It could be playing cards. It could be just reading to them. It could be, yeah, just sitting or watching TV. One of the guys liked watching race car, you know, stuff. So it just varies.
My father liked to watch TV. I discovered there is a 24/7 Western channel.
Ooh.
It was a good thing. It was a good thing for him.
Yeah.
So if people want to volunteer, if they want to say, hey, I would like to give back in some way, and I think I could do the respite, or I'd be better on the back end, or I have a big truck and I could deliver materials.
Oh, we would love more volunteers, especially for the medical equipment transportation. We get calls once or twice a week where I need to get a bed to and from, either delivered to a home or out of the home. And they can call our office at 463-6111, and they will transfer them to me. It's a very simple process, though, to get signed up as a volunteer, especially for that kind of stuff. We definitely have to do a background check because you're going into folks' home, and then the other only requirement is a TB test and a little bit of paperwork. But pretty minor. We like to keep it simple but safe. And then, but to be a volunteer for the respite and bereavement part, there's a training that we try to conduct. I think they're going to be doing it once a year at least. And so if you're interested in that, we will definitely try and key you into when those take place and just fill out the paperwork as well.
That sounds great. So we're talking with Colleen Jones of Hospice and Home Care. She's a volunteer coordinator. She's talking about volunteer opportunities, but there's also the Whale Watch Cruise, one of their major fundraisers. It's going to take place this Saturday from 1 to 4. You have to buy tickets in advance, and there's only maybe a dozen left. So you definitely want to call 463-6111. It's $60 to go whale watching, which we all know is a bargain. And the cost includes a little food, and all the proceeds, thanks to the generosity of Allen Marine Tours, will go to Hospice and Home Care.
Yes, thank you very much.
Is there anything else you want to add?
No, just come out and support Hospice by coming and watching some whales on the water.
All right, give them a buzz, 463-6111.
Flashing its tail. Then he got a sailor's dream about cruising around on the salty sea, joining up with a fishing crew to go out and get him a whale or two. Tell me, what kind of men are these that sail upon the salty seas, up in the rigging in the afternoon, swabbing the deck and sharpening harpoons? Hooray, up she rises! Hooray, up she rises! Rain up she rises early in the morning. The rain up she rises. The rain up she rises. The rain up she rises early in the morning. Shanghai's by the light of the moon. Put out the Boston in the middle of June. Now for 6 months out at sea is nothing but death and misery. Set off on a 3-year cruise, the Union ship and the Union crew. Six months you begin to see that whaling's not what it used to be. The modern ship and the modern crew, with sonar scopes and exploding harpoons, a mechanical boat made out of steel, a blown machine built to kill all the whales. Hooray, up she rises. 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 Chop them in two and melt them down and sell it to you. The hardly is a sailor alive, and keep the tears from his eyes as he remembers the good old days when there were no whales to save. Thank the Russians and Japanese for scouring
traded for ivory and perfume, plastic toys and pet food. Hooray, up she rises, hooray, up she rises. Out. Clap your hands, come on. Hey, 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 come on. Hey, clap your hands, come on.
Earning power. Earn a bachelor's degree from anywhere with e-learning at the University of Alaska Southeast. Online programs include history, psychology, English, communication, and many others. More information at ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Hi, this is Tyler Tullis. I'm a student with the CARES Summer School Program. Please join me and other CARES students as we share our podcast about biology on Focus on Community this Monday night at 7 on K2 News Juno. Thanks!
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 17th of June, 2013. On this day in 1885, the Statue of Liberty arrived in New York Harbor on board the French frigate Isere, a gift from France to the United States to commemorate the centennial and the friendship between the two countries that began during the American Revolution. The statue arrived in 350 individual pieces and would not be erected for another 4 months. is the birthday of novelist and journalist John Hersey, born in China to missionary parents, graduated from Yale, served as a foreign correspondent for Life and Time. He was commissioned by The New Yorker to write a piece on the aftermath of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. He structured his reporting around personal narratives, focusing on the experiences of six people living there at the time of the explosion. When it hit newsstands in August of 1946, it sold out immediately and was published as Hiroshima soon after. And it's the birthday of poet Ron Padgett, born in Tulsa. When he was growing up in Oklahoma, a dry state back then, his father made a living as a bootlegger. Padgett read voraciously as a child, began jotting down poems in spiral notebooks when he was only 13. He went to Columbia University and studied at the Sorbonne in France on a Fulbright scholarship. His poetry collections include Tulsa Kid, Poems I Guess I Wrote, Great Balls of Fire, and How to Be Perfect. And it's the birthday of the composer Igor Stravinsky, born in Russia, 1882. His first major success as a composer was a ballet based on a Russian folktale called The Firebird. Wildly popular, he traveled all over to conduct The Firebird. Then he got an idea for a ballet about a pagan ritual in which a virgin would be sacrificed to the gods by dancing herself to death. Stravinsky composed the piece on a piano in a rented cottage, and a boy walking outside his window kept shouting up at him that the chords were all wrong. He titled the piece The Rite of Spring. At its premiere in 1913 in Paris, the audience broke out into a riot when the music and dancing turned harsh and dissonant. Police came to calm the chaos. Stravinsky left his seat in disgust, but the performance continued for 33 more minutes, and he became recognized ultimately as one of the most famous composers in the world and the founder of modern music. And here's a poem by Ron Padgett, The Swiss Family Robinson. I never quite understood who the Swiss Family Robinson were. The inversion of their name confused me at an early age, just as the name of Mary Baker Eddy sounded as though she started out as a woman and turned into a guy named Eddie. At Walt Disney World, there is an attraction called Swiss Family Robinson that involves a treehouse, so I assume they lived in a tree. Why they did, I don't know. It sounds rather stressful to me, the fear of falling out. I could look up the Swiss Family Robinson in a reference book, but it's interesting not to know something that everyone else knows. However, I would like to know if there are many people named Robinson in Switzerland. If there are, I would know something that most people don't know. A poem by Ron Padgett, The Swiss Family Robinson, from How to Be Perfect, published by Coffee House Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping individuals and businesses make their best impression where people learn about them first on the Internet. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
Hello, you are listening to KTOO News Juno. This is Juno Afternoon, the Monday, June 16th edition. I'm your Monday host, Joan Pardis. In the studio with me every Monday is Jeff Brown. It's making me sound good. Thank you, Jeff. And speaking of Writer's Almanac, next week I'm really excited. We're having a telephone conversation with Ewan Ivey. Ewan wrote Snow Child, The Snow Child, which is a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and she's based in Alaska. She's in the Matsu area, and she's going to be joining us by phone next Monday. And also, Courtney Nelson will be joining us in the studio to talk about the new spa in town, the Now Oasis, Northern Northern Oasis Wellness Spa. It's got saunas and excellent massage, so Courtney will be here to talk about that next Monday. But right now, we'll be talking with Sabrina Javier, who is here in the studio with us, and she is the local coordinator for Student Travel Services, the Student Travel Services Foundation. Hi, Sabrina.
Hi, Joan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in on this lovely day. So, the local coordinator for Student Travel Services Foundation, how long have you been doing that?
So, this is my first year doing this. I enjoy working with people and working with people from different countries especially, too. So.
Okay, great. So let's talk about it. What is the Student Travel Service Foundation?
So the STS Foundation, it's a nonprofit organization. Basically what we do is we promote, intercultural student exchange. We work mostly with high school international student exchange students. Excuse me. That's a tongue twister. And we find prospective host families for these students. And we just kind of go through that whole process of finding the right family for the right student or students.
Okay. So this organization, the Student Travel Service Foundation, it's an international organization, and you're the local coordinator here in Juneau. So you're dealing with finding host families for the students that are coming here. What about the students going somewhere else? Is that...
That's usually worked out of the national office in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure how it works with outgoing students, but
right.
I just basically work with the incoming students.
Okay. And how many do you have coming in?
I've got a handful. I have anywhere between 7 to 10 students looking for housing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what are the responsibilities of a host family?
Well, basically the host family just has to provide a bedroom. And it can be shared with their child, if they're the same sex. But they provide them with 2 meals a day and just a place to sleep. And that's basically all. Just make them feel at home. They are a part of your family, so they do partake in chores and, follow the rules. And basically, they just want to be a part of your family. They want to learn about, Alaskan or American culture. And it's a great way to introduce a different culture to your home as well. So they come from everywhere. They come from Finland, Norway, Poland, China, Thailand, you name it. They come from everywhere. So,
wow, that sounds terrific. And how long is the commitment? When do the students usually arrive in Juneau?
So we try to get them here a little before the school year starts. So they get here usually early August, and then they'll leave shortly after school ends in June. So, but they usually stay the whole year, and it's basically based upon the family. If the family, say the family goes on like a family vacation during winter break, the student can stay, or usually the students would like to just go with the family, and they have, they're usually covered with their own health insurance and their own travel money to do stuff like that. So they're very well prepared.
Okay. So before we get into the ins and outs, because I know that one of my friends had an exchange student, and they went out of town, and then they kind of had another host family. So there's a lot of different ways. So if you're not going to be here 24/7 for
right.
all, how many weeks it is, 40 weeks or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is, that there's ways to come up with creative solutions. But the students are 15 to 18 years of age. They come from all over the place. And do you know the process of how they wind up in Juneau?
Well, they can't choose where they go is how it works.
Okay.
So there's local coordinators all over the United States. And these are students particularly that want to come to the U.S., practice their English, go to a U.S. school. So we basically grab them out of a pool of, we just say, hey, this student sounds like he or she might fit with this family. And then we kind of work with that and just keep the process going. And, the family has to go through a background check, and then their homes have to be inspected by me just to make sure that everything is safe and sound, of course, for a child. So
right. So when you said 7 to 10, you have 7 to 10 candidates that have been chosen for Juneau or that look like good candidates, or if you could find 7 to 10 homes? Or
They look like they would be good candidates for Juneau, and if I could find them some homes here in Juneau, I think that they'd fit in very well.
Okay.
Just their interests are, I go by their hobbies and interests.
great. So so it's a good match, so everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm.
So if people want to learn more about becoming a host family, is there a website that they could go to?
Yes. The website is www.stsfoundation.org, or they can always contact me or ask me any questions, and my number is 907-957-0718.
Okay. And then do they have any say of what student they get?
Not necessarily, no. You know, I do my best to try to match the student with the family. A lot of the times if a family has a child or children, I try to match up the hobbies. You know, if the student plays basketball and their child plays basketball, I try to find, you know, a student that plays basketball so that they can have similar hobbies and do those things together. But not necessarily. Like, they aren't allowed to pick and choose from the list. So I try to do that for
right.
them. So.
But could they say, oh, we would really appreciate a female? Or
oh,
we
absolutely.
Would, we think that, but we can't say, we want a female from Finland.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Alrighty. And did you ever participate in an exchange program when you were younger?
I never did, no, but as a student at UAS, I did a study abroad program to Russia, and I did archaeological field school there last summer, actually. I was there at this time last summer.
Where were you in Russia?
I was in the Komi Republic doing, what was I doing? I was doing a lot of things, but the most memorable one was staying with reindeer herding families. So the Komi Republic is just west of the Ural Mountains. So we stayed with reindeer herding families and watched that whole process. It was very neat.
Wow. What was the weather like?
Hot.
It was hot.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And were these semi-subsistence? Was the people with the families you stayed with, was it a semi-subsistence
yes.
culture?
Yes, it was.
Oh, wow. And what did they speak?
They speak Russian, but uh-huh. they also speak, it's kind of a mix of the different cultures. So it's very diverse in that area, but they speak Nenets and Komi, but they have been acculturated to speak Russian.
Okay. And do you speak Russian?
Very, very little.
Do you understand Russian?
Very little.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you came back, and is that when you said, oh, wow, it might be fun to coordinate this here in Juneau?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I enjoy working with cultures, and I think with an anthropology background, that's just sort of what I'm interested in. So.
Alrighty. And what other support do the host families get from the organization?
Well, the host families, they don't, the found, because it's a nonprofit, they don't necessarily get like any sort of stipend, but they are allowed to put it on their taxes as a charitable donation. So I think it's $50 for every month that they host a student.
Okay. That's interesting, but I'm sorry, I wasn't really specific. I wasn't really talking about financial support.
Oh, no.
But that is interesting to know that it's a little bit of a tax write-off, but I didn't really think that there was financial support.
Oh, no.
But I was wondering what kind of other support do they have from you besides the match? Are there, like, events for these students during
yes.
the year? You know, that type of
yes,
thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Like the resources mm-hmm. and support
so
throughout the year.
It's mandatory that every 30 days I check up on the students. And so usually what I'll try to do is gather all of them, you know, at a time that fits them best. And we'll go out and, you know, explore, maybe do the West Glacier Trail or go up to the tram or something like that. But I try to coordinate something with the students.
Right. And how do you think it's going to work as far as the language barriers?
Well, the students are actually, they get tested on their English proficiency. So all the students have to speak English very well. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to be on this program. And they also have to maintain an above B average to come to be in this program. So they're very smart, articulate, and they can speak English very well.
And there's an intensive screening process,
yes.
I would imagine.
Yes.
So we're talking with Sabrina Javier of the Student Travel Service Foundation, who works here in Juneau looking for host families for students who are coming here, high school students, 15 to 18 years old. And if you are interested in becoming a host family, you should contact Sabrina. And what are those contact info?
Yes, so you can contact me at... on my cell phone, it's 907-957-0718, or by email. It's sabrina.javier@gmail.com, and my last name is spelled J-A-V-I-E-R.
Okay, and if they just search for Student Travel Service Foundation in Juneau, something would come up as well.
Yes, and you can also go on the website at www.stsfoundation.org and then just contact the national office, and they will direct you my way.
Right, and then I would also encourage you, if you're looking for the flip side of this story, if you're looking for an opportunity for your child to go somewhere, you could probably research that in the same place.
Mm-hmm.
So that'd be great. Sabrina, is there anything else you want to add?
No, I just hope there are some families out there, and this is just a great opportunity for a family to introduce a new culture to their home. So
sounds like a great opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
And we're going to go to Bird Note right now.
So our next speaker is Meg Cartwright. Meg has spent most of her adult life in Alaska. She was lured from the big city lifestyle to make money on the pipeline in the mid-70s. Instead, she fell in love with the outer beauty of Alaska and started scheming ways to make a living outdoors. This brought her to the beginning of a 30-year career. She's now retired with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game as a fisheries biologist. The story she will tell tonight happened the third year as a fisheries technician on McDonald Lake, about 30 miles north of Ketchikan. Little did she know that it would turn out to be one of the most memorable experiences of her entire career. The title of her talk gives you a hint of what was to unfold. And the title is, let me put it this way, if Alfred Hitchcock was to film a sequel to his story, The Birds, on location in southeast Alaska at McDonald Lake in the early 1980s, it would be Alfred Hitchcock's The Fish, the title of Meg's talk. Here she is.
So the story I'm going to tell you tonight is a real fish story. And in the 1970s, the salmon returns to Alaska were at a record low. So Fish and Game decided to spend pumping millions of dollars into enhancement projects, salmon enhancement projects. The fisheries scientists decided that McDonald Lake could quadruple the number of fry living in the lake for 1 to 2 years before they go out to the ocean with a lake fertilization project. So, but the problem was they didn't know how many fish, adult fish, were coming back in this system. Nobody had studied this system. So they hired George and I to go out, build a weir, and figure out an accurate number of fish that were going into the lake. Now, for those of you who don't know what a weir is, it's a fence that they put across the stream to block fish temporarily from going upstream to the spawning grounds. Now, when a fish comes up behind the weir, they move along the weir trying to find a hole. And the personnel who are operating the weir will go out, open up a 2-foot section, stand over the hole, wait till the fish find it, and then they count the number of fish going through with a tally counter. So George and I had put the weir in by June 1st, and then we waited for the fish, and then we waited, and we waited. Almost 2 months we waited for fish. We had about 50 fish through the weir on a daily basis. But then one day, when it had rained hard for 3 nights, the water started coming up in the stream, and we spent the rest of the day patching the top of the weir, adding more fence, so the fish, as the water rise, wouldn't just jump over it. We didn't go in to have lunch until 4 o'clock. I ate quickly because I was kind of worried about that water. It was coming up a foot every 3 hours. And George said he'd be out in a minute. He wanted to listen to Paul Harvey the rest of the story. So I said, okay, fine. So I'm paddling out to the weir, and it's the first time I realize there is something that's changed a lot in the mere 20 minutes that I'd gone in for lunch. The whole fish trap was packed with fish. There was no water left in the trap. So I quickly parked the boat, went around to the other side. I froze. George! No answer. He was listening to Paul Harvey. I looked across the back of the weir. there were at least 30,000 or 40,000 fish that had come in that 20 minutes. Almost all of them sockeye. I could have walked across their backs. Now, the width of this weir was about the width of the Foodland parking lot, just to give you an idea of how many fish. And when I looked downstream, all I could see were fish all the way. And later we found out the fish were backed up all the way to saltwater, a mile and a half down this stream. George! Still George, no George. So I got on the weir. I opened up that 2-foot section. And I started to count the fish through, and it was like, oh! So I necked down the opening to 3 inches. The fish were literally going through on top of each other. I had 6,000 fish through that weir in 10 minutes. George shows up. He starts to count, and I start going to add more fencing as the water is coming up. It's about 4 feet from what it was in the morning. And now it's George's turn. Meg! So I go over, and I say, what? And he says, I think the fish are going to push this weir over. And I'm thinking, oh, no. What are we going to do? We aren't going to get an accurate count. We can't count the number of species, but maybe we could reconstruct that. On the other hand, if they push the weir, we're done. We won't have any information. So I said, okay, George, we're going to each open up about 4 feet, and we're just going to count the number of fish. That's all we're going to do. And it went like this, by hundreds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. We counted until it was dark that night. We got up at 3 o'clock the next morning to continue to count. When I went by the water level gauge, I realized the water had peaked 6 feet overnight, sometime in the middle of the night, and was starting to go down. We got reinforcements at... people came in from Ketchikan on day 3. By the end of day 4, we had 80,000 sockeye through that weir. 130,000 sockeye were estimated at the end of the season when we took the weir out mid-September. The magnitude of this run had international significance. The U.S. and Canada were just sitting down to renegotiate a salmon treaty under the assumption that there were not more than 30,000 sockeye in any system in Southeast Alaska. So the negotiating team got our daily weir counts. Fish and Game decided to go ahead and fertilize this lake, and thinking that more fish on top of more fish is right, yeah? So they jacked up the number of salmon fry being produced in the lake, which jacked up the number of adults returning. Then they jacked up the commercial harvest and increased the limit of the personal use fishery. Everybody was happy in the land of plenty. That was until 20 years later, when the poor returns to McDonald Lake forced Fish and Game to list it as a stock of concern. And lastly, I know you thought this was a story about the fish, but it's really about the water. Remember when I told you it came up 6 feet overnight? If you want to know the rest of my story, come talk to me after.
Now, obviously, that was not Bird Note. That was a fish story. That was an excerpt from Mudrooms. It was Meg Cartwright sharing her story about her Fish and Game experience, and it was definitely a fish story, not a bird note. But we are going to have to wrap up the show now, so I'm going to go right to the weather. So tonight, increasing clouds with isolated thunderstorms in the evening and scattered showers late. Lows around 54, southwest wind 5 to 15 miles per hour, becoming southeast overnight. Wind gusts to 40 miles per hour near thunderstorms. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, isolated showers. High 68 to 73. Had to choke on that. That is still pretty warm. Southeast wind 5 to 15 miles per hour. Tuesday is cloudy, isolated showers, and still high in the 60s up into the 70s for the rest of the week. And tomorrow, please join Martha Moore on Juno Afternoon. She's got a very interesting lineup of guests. She's got Oren Hertz about his new book, Journey Toward Eternal Life. Ken Fix will be in the studio to highlight the retro sci-fi movie at the Planetarium tomorrow night. Jordan Nigro will be here to talk about the details of Saturday's Only Fools Run and many more. So have a great day. You've been listening to KTOO News Juno.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tune to K276 AF 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at www.ktoo.org.
You're the proof of what is possible, because hope is contagious. They're watching to see what you do next.
President Obama tells young people in Northern Ireland they can be a model for the world.
It's Monday, June 17th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel.